This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Gary Clinton. Maybe you know the name, maybe you don't. I have no idea. Maybe this is the first time you've ever listened to this show. Every now and then I do think that I should just take a few seconds and explain that this is a show about audio. Mostly we do old radio, but sometimes, like today, we'll also pick up a reading of a short story or a poem. Even occasionally a news item, anything really that strikes my interest. Later on today, towards the end, we're going to have a reading of a Robert Howard short story. We're going to start off with a story from Suspense from February the 21st of 1948. And as a lot of these old radio anthologies did, it's an adaptation of a classic short story, in this case by Algernon Blackwood, called Ancient Sorceries. Now, Escape changed it quite a bit. They changed the location from France to Wales. They changed the name of the town it happens in. They changed the name of the protagonist to Arthur Llewellyn. Llewellyn with two L's. You know how they do that in Wales. They seem to be fond of these two L's. The adaptation is pretty good, but I would strongly recommend that you look up the Algernon Blackwood story, which you can actually do by just going to my website, www.nighttransmissions.com. Once you get there, click on the navigation menu where it says The Shows. Click on Show 20, go down to the bottom where it says Downloads. You'll find a PDF version of the Algernon Blackwood short story. Anyway, that's for later. For now, we have Escape.
Escape. Produced by William N. Robeson and carefully contrived to free you from the four walls of today for a half hour of high adventure.
Today we escape to a remote section of Wales and a strange village between two worlds, as Algernon Blackwood described it in his eerie story, Ancient Sorceries. I had spent a week's vacation in Wales and was returning to London by train when it all began. It was late afternoon. We'd left the Welsh mountains and crossed the border into Western England, passing through a countryside which appeared singularly empty, deserted of life. Over the soft hills and the valleys between hung a faintly perceptible haze, giving to the whole landscape a feeling of enchantment and unreality. The train slowed at length to stop at a tiny wayside station. As it did so, a sudden thought occurred to me. Why not leave the crowded train with its irritating noises and spend the night in this peaceful spot, then take a slower and emptier train in the morning? On the impulse, I rose from my seat, and the man sitting opposite me said,
Why say, sir? We only stopped here for a minute or two. If you were thinking of walking about a bit.
No, matter of fact, I'm getting off here.
I thought you were going to London.
I'll go on in the morning. I'm going to stay here for the night.
I strongly advise you not to.
I beg your pardon?
This is the village of Malton.
Malton? I've never heard of it.
Few people have, outside. But if you place any value on your soul, you'll not spend the night here.
What are you talking about? Why not?
Because of the sleep. And because of the cats. That's all I can tell you.
You're insane. I'll take my bag now, if you don't mind.
You're making a terrible mistake. You may not even get the chance to regret it. Don't leave this train. I know what I'm talking about.
Oh, what utter nonsense.
Don't. Don't, I tell you.
Goodbye.
Work!
I stood there on the embankment as the train pulled away. What was the matter with the man anyway? Cats, sleep. His words made no sense. I picked up my bag and started walking up the long hill toward the village, and suddenly, for no reason at all, I shivered. Hello? Hello, is anyone here?
Yes?
Oh, I didn't see you at first.
Is there something I can do for you, sir?
Why, yes, I saw your sign outside, the Inn of the Golden Bough. I should like to get a room.
You're planning to stay here?
Why, yes.
Very well. You may sign the register. Yeah.
Thank you. I'm going to catch another train and go on in the morning.
Yes, of course.
There we are.
Arthur Llewellyn. Llewellyn?
Yes, from London.
Arthur Llewellyn. You've been a long time coming back.
What?
But now that you're here, you'll find there are some things that never change.
Madam, I'm afraid I don't know what you're talking about.
You rang, madam?
Dundreary. The gentleman would like a room for the night. His name is Arthur Llewellyn.
Aye, so it is. Welcome back to Malton, sir.
I knew I'd never been here before. What was it all about? First the men on the train, and now these people. Were they crazy, or was I? Oh, well. I left the inn and walked along narrow cobbled streets, beneath quaint gables leaning out from the silent, shuttered houses, through dappled pools of light and shadow. As I walked, it gradually dawned upon me that the village of Malton was centuries old, older than any town in England ought to be. And the people I passed now and then were dressed in the fashion of another day. They paid no attention to me, went silently about their own business. Yes, that was it. That's what I'd been noticing. Silently. As I walked, I noticed they came and went with only soft padding sounds to mark their passing, as though they walked in shoes with soles of velvet. When I stopped, there was no sound. The silence was unbroken. I hurried through the streets and came at last to the far side of the village, to a place where the hill broke away sharply from a low, flat wall of stone, perhaps a rampart once. I sat down upon it, and the dreamy tranquility of the place stole over me. Presently, I don't know how much later, I became aware of the sound of weird music rising out of the vale below me. I looked down from the rampart. The sunken plain at the bottom melted away into a sea of gathering shadow, blurred into a swirl of thickening mist. I thought of dead trees swept by the night wind, of animals with half-human voices singing to a white moon, of the wailing of cats on the roof tiles at night, of unearthly creatures far off in the sky calling to one another in chorus. I felt my heart beat faster and faster, felt the vague stirrings of some urge inside of me trying to answer the awful call of that music. I fought against the feeling, fought against myself. And even as I did, I found I was staring down into that valley, peering desperately into the dark mist, trying to see I don't know what. And then suddenly, the music ended. I stood on the rampart alone, dusk fallen about me, and the early night wind moaned with a chill breath. Quick terror rose up in me. I turned and ran on through the darkened streets, ran with heart pounding, dodging its shadows, through one dim alley after another, and arrived at last panting and almost breathless at the door of the Golden Bough.
You've been a long time returning, Mr. Llewellyn. It's past 7.
Yes, I guess I walked farther than I meant to. I didn't realize it was so late.
You heard the music, didn't you?
Yes. Yes, the strangest music I've ever heard. How did you know? Who plays it, anyway?
Then you didn't remember it?
No. Why should I? The thing was becoming irritating. This quiet insistence that I was someone else. I went into my lonely dinner and ate as quickly as possible. Then, taking the candle Dundreary gave me, I crossed the lobby, climbed the stairs behind the desk, and walked past silent doors down the long, empty hall that led to my room at the end. I was halfway to my door when suddenly the flame of my candle went out. I stood stock still in the pitch blackness, fumbling for a match. And at that moment, I knew that someone or something was there with me in the darkness. I held my breath and listened. There was no sound, no movement. I reached out and found the wall and moved along and feeling my way in the inky blackness. It was then I touched it. Near my face, another soft, warm, yielding. And alive. Who? Who is it?
It is I, Ilse.
Who?
Ilse. Don't you remember me, Arthur?
No. No.
But wouldn't you like to remember me? Don't you want to see me again? To look at me? Now?
I don't know.
But not tonight, Arthur. Perhaps tomorrow. 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 Tomorrow.
I stumbled blindly through the door of my room and shut it behind me. I lit the candle and flung myself across the bed. The room was small, with one shuttered window, and the light of the flame flickered on the walls and ceiling. I stared at the hand that had touched her out there in the dark hall. I lifted it to my face and smelled the barbaric scent that still clung to my fingers. It was evil and maddening. The candle sputtered and burned, and the melted minutes dripped away. Who was I? Who were these people? Who was Ilse? I fell asleep finally, and dreamed of soft moving creatures, and the silence of life in a dim, muffled world devoid of all feeling but ecstasy. And I dreamed, too, of cats.
You've slept quite late this morning, Mr. Llewellyn.
Morning, Dundreary. I felt as though I'd been drugged.
The night air here in Malton is very conducive to sleep.
I'd meant to catch the morning train to London. Now it's too late.
What a terrible shame.
Yes, I... Oh, by the way, Dundreary.
Yes, Mr. Llewellyn?
Do you... I mean, I was wondering if you'd know anyone by the name of Ilse.
Ilse happens to be my daughter, Mr. Llewellyn.
Oh, I didn't hear you come in.
I hope you were able to sleep well. Without unpleasant dreams?
I guess so.
I'm so happy to hear it. Perhaps then you may decide to stay with us for a long time.
That's very kind of you.
No, it's not kindness, Mr. Llewellyn. But all of us are hoping that you may decide soon.
Decide? Decide what? It was no use. None of them would answer my questions. They seemed to think I should know already. I left the inn as soon as I'd eaten, walked around the streets of the village. I began to notice I was never completely alone. If I turned down an empty street, someone always stepped from a doorway or entered from the opposite end. Wherever I went, within 5 minutes, a dozen people were strolling near me. And I realized these people were watching me tensely, as a cat watches a mouse or another cat.
Fortunate you came back early, Mr. Llewellyn. Your dinner this evening is a rather special one.
Special? What do you mean by that?
You are to have a guest.
Oh, who?
An old friend. She's coming now.
The girl who came toward us across the room was lithe and slim. She moved with the sinuous grace of a young panther. She was lovely. Exotic and terrifyingly beautiful.
May I present Mr. Arthur Llewellyn, Miss Ilse? He's been with us for 2 days.
Yes, I know. My mother told me. May I sit down, Mr. Llewellyn?
Oh, yes, please do. Here, permit me.
Thank you. You may serve us, Dundreary.
Thank you, Miss Ilse.
Then, you're Ilse?
Yes. Don't you remember me, Arthur?
From last night. It was you last night, wasn't it?
Yes, and other nights. Can't you remember all the other nights?
No. No.
Then we shall have to try that much harder. It's been such a very long time.
Please, Ilse. What is it all of you talk about? I don't understand any of it.
You will, Arthur. Unless you leave, of course. Weren't you planning to take a train to London in the morning?
Yes. No. No, I've changed my mind.
I'm glad you did. We'll try to make you happy here, my mother and I. And then perhaps you'll stay a long, long time.
No. I must leave for sure in a day or two.
Suppose we wait and see. And meanwhile, if there's anything you want, all you have to do is ask me.
All right. Why don't you tell me about...
Yes, Arthur. About what?
No. No, I don't want to know. I don't want you to tell me. Suddenly I realized I was afraid to know. I was afraid... I should leave now, but I couldn't leave. It was Ilse. She attracted, repelled, fascinated, and horrified me, all in single flashes of blasting emotion. I felt the presence of a great gray curtain ready to roll back at any moment and leave me on the brink of an awful adventure. And I knew the village held its breath, watched and waited. And then on the evening of the fifth day, the whole ghastly secret exploded into hideous life. After dinner, Ilse had asked me to walk with her. It was the first time I'd been outside the inn after dark. We walked through the village in the moonlight, saying very little, and came finally to the stone rampart above the sunken plain. We were quite alone.
Look, Arthur.
Hmm?
It's a full moon tonight. Do you know what that means?
Yes. It means I can see more clearly how beautiful you are.
Do you really believe that? Do you think I'm beautiful?
Hmm. Like a soft, sleek leopard in a warm jungle of shadows. But wait, I'll see you even better in a moment.
Arthur, what are you doing?
These dry leaves by the wall. They'll make an excellent bonfire. There. There, you see?
No. No.
What's wrong?
The fire. No, Arthur, put it out.
All right, Ilse. Don't worry, it's all right. There. Didn't even get a chance to get started. There, you see, it's out.
Yes, I see.
Why did it bother you so much?
Don't you remember? Don't you remember the fire?
No. What fire?
No. Don't talk of it. Look at me instead. Look at me, Arthur.
Yes, Ilse?
Arthur, do you love me?
Yes. Yes, Ilse, I love you.
I'm glad. That means you'll come back to us, then.
I don't know what you mean, Ilse.
You can know everything tonight, if you want to.
Yes, I do. I do, Ilse.
You must know a part of it already, down inside. You must remember some of it, don't you?
Yes. It's like something buried for centuries, deep inside of me. Now it's beginning to come alive.
Let it come alive. Don't fight against it. You belonged to us once, long ago, and you still belong.
Yes. I seem to know that.
That's why you came back. You heard me calling. You heard them calling. And you came seeking the old life again.
Yes, but... Ilse, I'm afraid.
Are you afraid of me? Look at me.
Ilse.
Will you live the old life again? With me tonight?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, I've known that you would, because I own you, Arthur. You belong to me, and I want you to come with me. I shall never let you escape from me again.
Yes, yes.
Go back to the inn, then. Wait for me, Arthur. I shall come for you tonight.
Back at the inn, I paced the floor of my room, a tense, uncontrollable excitement driving me along in a nervous frenzy. The dry crypt of the memory had broken open, and all the things I'd hidden away for centuries poured into my consciousness. I knew now why I'd come here. I knew what I was going to do. And I knew that I was lost. I sensed the rising stir of movement throughout the inn and outside in the courtyard below my window. I knew what to expect when I threw open the window. From every window of the inn and from those of the houses about the court were leaping great monstrous beasts with soft dark fur and eyes that gleamed with eerie phosphorescence. Cats! Cats of human size! This was the secret of Molten. Lycanthropy. The witchcraft of centuries long dead and buried. The half-human cries floated up to me, and the moon cast their dark shadows on the ground as they padded across the courtyard and vanished through the narrow streets of the village, heading for a hideous rendezvous. This is what I'd been. This is what I wanted to be now. I scarcely heard the door of the room open behind me.
Are you ready, my love? Shall we join them?
Yes.
Here, Arthur. The sacred bomb made of vervain and mistletoe and blind things out of the sea. Remember?
Yes. Yes, I remember.
Take it. Use it. We'll change now. Transform. Leap from the window and join them. Lead us again, Arthur.
Yes. But not here, Ilse. Not yet. Wait until we get there. Then we'll change.
If you wish. Come then, Arthur, to the stone wall above the grove. That's where we'll change, on the stone rampart.
In the grove on the sunken plain beneath the wall, insane shadows writhed in the moonlight and postured in the luminous mist. A thousand of the devil's own were dancing in an unearthly music born from the harmony of the black sacrifice, crying out in delirious abandon, calling to the thing that now lived inside of me and struggled screaming in my skull, trying to answer them back. I fought against them, fought against Ilse, pleading and clinging with her soft arms about my neck.
Now, Arthur, come with me now if you love me.
I love you, but I can't do it. I can't do it. Not again, Ilse.
Yes, my love, only an instant to change, and then we'll live forever.
Is it living without a soul?
Does it matter when I'm here?
Oh. No, once before I escaped. But I could never escape again. This time there'd be no turning back.
Am I not worth it? Look at me, my love.
I clung to the very edge of sanity, thought that I'd not be lost and damned forever. And at that very moment I knew what
Arthur,
I could do.
Wait. What are you doing?
found a match in my pocket, struck, dropped it into the dry leaves that lay banked along the whole length of the stone wall.
No. No, Alpha, don't. I can't come to you through the fire. You're driving me away.
Yes, go. Go into the valley, Ilse. Goodbye, Ilse. Goodbye.
You fool. You fool.
I turned from the wall of flame that for a few minutes would shut me off from the valley, ran through the moonlit streets, not back toward the Inn of the Golden Bough, but down the long road that led away from that cursed village of Malton.
Well, Mr. Llewellyn, I find this one of the most interesting cases of hallucination I've encountered since I began the practice of psychiatry.
I tell you, it really happened, Doctor.
And having investigated your story a bit during the past week, I'm in a position now to answer most of the questions that have been worrying you since you came back to London.
What do you mean, investigated?
I went up to Hereford and looked over some of the old records there. And then I motored over to Malton for a couple of hours.
Well, then you know it's all true. You saw it. You know I was there.
Oh, there's no question but what you were there, Mr. Llewellyn. The lady who runs the inn showed me your name in the register. Said you'd left quite suddenly without taking your luggage or paying your bill. She was really quite put out.
I see. Well, what about the records, Doctor? The ones you spoke of?
I think they really explain the whole thing, Mr. Llewellyn. It seems that during the 14th century, the village of Malton became a kind of headquarters in that part of the country for the practice of witchcraft.
Yes. Go on.
Numerous trials were held there in the late 1300s, and a great many men and women were convicted of sorcery and burned to death.
Yes.
In the records of a trial in 1372, I found the name of an Arthur Llewellyn and of Ilse and her mother.
That proves it, then.
Yes. Proves a clear case of hallucination. You knew that story before you went there. Not consciously, but somewhere down in your latent memory.
I knew nothing of it before.
That man was an ancestor of yours. The story must have been known in your family. When you arrived in Malton accidentally, the association of the name just pulled the trigger, and your imagination did the rest.
But, Doctor, my parents died when I was four. I've never been around any of my family.
No matter. You see, a childhood memory is amazingly persistent at times.
Yes. Yes, I suppose it is. I knew then what I had to do. The only thing I could do. There'd be no use in talking further with the doctor. He'd find some phrase of science to cover everything. He'd even try to explain away the mark I still carried across my shoulder where Ilse had thrown her arm about me in those last mad minutes on the rampart. A mark that was covered with a soft gray fur like the fur of a cat. Yes, I knew now what had to be done. And must be done while I still retained my sanity. One last act. Final and irrevocable. An act that begins by walking into the railway station at Charing Cross.
Good evening, sir. May I help you?
Yes. I'd like a ticket to Malton.
Malton? I don't believe I have...
It's a village on the Swansea line near the border of Wales.
Oh, yes. Yes, here it is. I don't believe I've ever sold a ticket to Malton before.
I don't doubt it.
Let's see now. 4 and 6. Single fare. First class. Did you wish a return or one way? What did you say?
Oh. Oh, I'm sorry. I... Make it one way.
Well, we got our first break here. But I'll be back very, very shortly with our next radio play, The Devil and Mr. O. Devil and Mr. O was really just a series of rebroadcasts of some of Arch Obler's offerings on Lights Out that were originally broadcast from 1942 and 1943. Arch Obler was the host, and tonight we have The Hungry One from January the 14th of 1972. The Hungry One, though, really is a rebroadcast, not a remake, a rebroadcast of 1942's Meteor Man.
Lights out for the devil and Mr. O. I've got a favor to ask of you. Listen to the story that I'm about to tell you historically. I mean that, historically. Now, this play was written when I was very young. I don't mean that I'm exactly history, but I do mean that this tale about a visitor from outer space was written long before motion pictures and television scoured the skies. It began one night many years ago when I stood on my California ranch and looked up at the great dome of the sky, and suddenly a shooting star burned in that night sky, larger and larger and larger.
Furthermore, I might speak frankly, my dear Diane. The basic thing wrong with woman is her nose. Let's cut it off.
Russell Adams.
Then there's the matter of her ears. Look at them.
Well?
They're too obvious. Cut them off, too.
No nose, no ears. Oh, a fine art critic you turned out to be.
Oh, is this thing art?
Russ Adams, I hate you. I think it's the best piece of sculpture I've ever done.
Egomaniac.
Oh, will you go away?
Not until I tell my wife how much I adore her. About stopping the artistic endeavors for the night and romancing with the old man.
Any night.
Come on. Out on the veranda. There's a moon.
Spoken as Professor Russell J. Adams, instructor of astronomy at our beloved university.
I don't know a single scientific fact about this moon. It's a special satellite built entirely for romance.
Then it's a date.
After you, fair Diane? Why do you laugh?
Just thinking it's a good thing we haven't any neighbors, or they'd think we were honeymooning.
10 years and 2 more weeks.
Sweet.
Why?
For remembering.
Where the sigh?
It's such a lovely night.
Yes. You're very lovely with the moonlight in your hair.
Darling.
335 days out of the year, moonlight to me is just a reflected light of the sun. A light interesting only that it may be analyzed spectroscopically. But these 30 days of our vacation, Diane... Oh, what a magical change. It's a soft lover's moon hanging in the heavens only to brighten your loveliness.
Oh, spoken like a true professor. Oh, Russell.
What's the matter?
I saw the brightest shooting star.
Is that all? The way you gasp, I thought you saw the angel of death himself galloping over those meadows.
There's another one. Look, Russell.
My dear, for 11 months out of the year, the heavens have my full and undivided attention. Oh, but during this blessed month... Let the heavens fall. I can't be bothered.
I never saw such bright shooting stars.
Yes, and another thing, my dear. As the wife of an accredited professor of astronomy, I think it no more than fitting that you give the phenomena that you observed its proper name. namely the fall of a meteor.
There's another one. And another. Oh, Russ, how bright and beautiful.
They travel at such a tremendous rate, the friction of our atmosphere burns them into a fiery vapor.
There's more of them. Look, one after the other. I've never seen so many shooting stars.
Uh-uh.
I mean so many meteors in all my life. Oh, so that's why you wanted me out here. You knew about this meteor shower, didn't you?
It's one of heaven's free spectacles in this constellation. Every 3 years, and this happens to be the third year.
How frightening.
Why frightening?
Those great masses of stone and iron coming from who knows where in interstellar space, traveling millions and millions of miles, and then going up in such glorious flame just as they reach the end of their journey.
Not all goes to flame. Hundreds of them strike the earth each year.
Oh, Russell, there's no danger.
Oh, no. The probabilities of being struck on the head by that cosmic rubbish is about 1,000 times more remote than winning a sweepstake without buying a ticket.
Oh, look. That one. The brightest of all.
Wait, Diane. What's that?
I don't know. Something from
look
the
up.
Sky. It's... shooting star!
Look out, Diane!
Russ.
All right, dear. Everything's all right.
What? How?
A meteor. You must have landed out in the field there. Here, let me help you up. You all right, dearest?
Yes, I'm all right. Russ, where are you going?
Out there. Where it must have buried itself. Wait here. I'll be right back.
No, no, I'm going with you.
All right, if you want to. Oh, Diane, what an experience we've had. The one chance in a million I spoke about almost occurred to us.
But Russ, was it really a shooting star? That explosion like a bombshell?
A bombshell of the universe.
What will we find out there?
A fragment of the meteorite, I
but
hope.
It'll burn.
No, no. All of its heat will have been dissipated. Then again, it may have exploded into 1,000 minute pieces. I pray to heaven that it hasn't.
I'm afraid.
No, no. The danger's all over. Here. Moon's so bright. If any of the mass landed, I should be able to find the torn ground where it smashed through the turf.
Oh, please, darling, let's wait until morning.
No, I must find the thing at once. The moon gives plenty of light. From the brightness of the flash, I'm positive that the meteor landed someplace right in here. I'll tell you. Look.
What?
The turf, all torn up. This is the place.
Russell, are you mad? Get up off the ground.
Right here. It must have struck a glancing blow off the brow of the ridge. I've got it.
What?
A fragment of it. Still warm. See? No larger than a baseball. All that was left of it.
That's a meteor?
A meteorite. All that's left of the meteor that burned and exploded. What a find.
Drop it, Russ.
What are you talking
about?
Throw
it away.
Come back to the house, quick.
What are you going to do with it?
Diane, what's the matter with you? Your face.
I don't know. Somehow I'm afraid for all of us.
Afraid? Good heavens, my dear. There's nothing dangerous about this. A mass of metal that's 90% iron. Why, it's as harmless as any inert piece of metal. Come to the study. I'll show you where the rush of air against the incandescent...
Russ, wait.
Huh?
Someone's crying.
Yes.
I'll go and see. It's Helga. Oh, Helga. You poor thing. We forgot all about you.
Oh, Mrs. Adams, it was exploding.
Now, now. Everything's all right, Helga.
What's going on, Diane?
Oh, poor Helga. The explosion frightened her out of her wits.
Oh, Mr. Professor Adams, we die. We all die.
Don't be a fool.
The fire, it come from the sky. It kill us. It kill you and me and everybody. We die. Everybody
stop it.
Die.
Stop it. For heaven's sake, stop it.
That.
Take care of her, Diane. Give her a sedative or something.
All right, Russell. All right, now, Helga. Everything's all right. Everything's right.
I'm going to get at this meteorite, so please quiet the dumb fool down as quickly as you can. Superstitious idiot. Simple phenomenon, and she thinks the world's ending. Simple little meteorite. Iron, bit of nickel content. Nothing particularly unusual. Oh, Diane, quiet her down, will you?
Yeah. She'll be all right.
You look a little rocky yourself. Here, sit here.
She's very frightened.
Yeah, and even you, Diane.
Well?
Well, you've acted so strangely, as if this inert piece of cosmic metal could cause some supernatural ability.
What are you going to do with it?
Nothing. Examine it. Here. I'll take some of this nitric acid. Where's that bottle? Here we are. Now watch closely, and I'll show you that the stone consists of ordinary elements. Iron.
Russell.
What?
This mark on it. How strange.
Yeah. Funny, I'd noticed it before.
Circles the entire stone.
I wouldn't be but surprised that a blow right here would break it in half. Yes, I think I'll try to do that.
No, Russ. Leave it alone.
Good heavens, Diane. Nothing but a stone. All I'm going to do is try and break it along this fissure. She had a hammer. Here. What if the stone break? Almost solid metal. I'll try. By George, it did. Clean in half. What?
Look. What's inside?
Flesh.
Oh, Russ, how?
Negative gray protoplasmic. No, it can't be. It can't. This is a meteor. It came from out there. There is no flesh. Nothing could live.
Russ, look.
Huh?
It's growing.
Growing?
I'm afraid.
No, Diane. No. Wait. Control yourself. This is something we've got to see, both of us, calmly, so we can tell others clearly what we saw.
I'll try. Oh, Russ. Keep your arm around me.
Larger and larger. Listen, the noise as it grows.
I hear it. When will it stop? When?
Look. Look.
I can't. That horrible gray flesh.
But you must see it. Look. It's forming into something.
What?
A head. It's forming into a head.
Oh!
How can it be, Diane? Flesh in a meteor growing. Growing into a head.
I see it. A head. Horrible head.
Diane, you heard.
Yes.
A head without body speaking.
Yes, speaking.
Russell.
You hear and understand me?
His lips laughing.
I laugh at the fear and wonder in your simple little faces.
Who are you? What are you?
If I told you, would your little earth minds understand?
Earth? Russ, what does it mean? What?
Yes, tell us, whatever you are. Tell us what you are.
What you on earth will soon have for masters.
Oh, Russ.
No, wait, Diane. I must know. You thing, what can I call you? Tell me what you mean, you masters.
Surely you simple little men do not think that in you creation has reached the ultimate.
No. Gray flesh talking. I'm getting out.
You will stay.
Russ, I can't move.
Nor I.
You cannot move.
Who are you? Tell us, who are you?
You saw how I came.
A tiny bit of protoplasm in that meteorite?
So I willed myself to be, to reach your earth.
You came here in that? Through space?
Through space beyond your furthest conception. Earth thing. Many of my people have tried. I am the first to succeed.
Then meteors are
the means we have used to try and reach this haven of plenty. I am the first. Now there will be others.
No.
You're from another planet?
And old world, old beyond your understanding, A world grown cold in its age, empty with passing years. We must escape to a young, fertile world. This world.
But you're only heads. Heads without bodies.
Oh, Russ. Russ, I'm so afraid.
No, please. I must hear him speak. This that is happening to us is a miracle of all times. Tell me, you there, are you only heads in that world you speak of?
Heads. Heads. You see what I will you to see.
But what are you?
A mind and a will beyond your feeble understanding. As far above you as you are above the apes that still must crawl in your jungle.
But how can it be that you speak as I speak and understand what I say?
Your prattling wearies me. But I tell you this. All that you say, I know. The most profound thought any of you earth things have ever thought is to me as the babbling of children. But now I am hungry. You understand that, little thing.
Hungry?
Hungry?
Hungry with a hunger that has driven me over space without ending. Hunger that has brought me here.
But what do you eat?
You will know.
What do you mean?
What food could there be here to fill the hunger of such as I? Hunger that would make me entomb myself in metal, flung into space in the hope that chance would bring me through the fire of that air of yours. What food, earthling?
I don't know. Tell me.
Come closer, earthling.
Oh, no.
And why, oh, no, earthling?
You don't... Human?
Human. You think you crawling worms are human to us.
But if you're man...
But we are not man. You are the cattle, and we are the keepers.
Oh.
You raise the cattle for life, and we for centuries have raised such as you on our world for life. But now, as I told you, our world has grown too old and too cold. The herds of you die, and we grow hungry. That is why I am here. We need new cattle. Here there are so many of you. Earthwoman.
Russell, it spoke to me.
We've got to get out of here.
Earthwoman.
No. Stop it. Don't look at me. Stop it.
Come closer.
No. Don't listen to him, Diane.
Closer.
No. Don't move, Diane. Stay where you are. Stay right there.
You hear only me, Earthwoman.
Only you.
No, Diane. No. Don't say that. Don't look at that monster, Diane.
Closer, Diane.
Yes.
No.
Closer.
No, Diane. Stand still. Don't move toward it. Don't.
Closer,
no,
Diane.
No, no.
Closer.
Monster. Not Diane. Diane, I beg of you, don't go closer to it.
Closer.
No.
Closer.
No. I'll kill you.
Closer.
If I could only get to you.
Closer.
Soon you will move to me as she
no.
is.
Closer.
No.
Diane.
Closer.
If I could move.
Closer.
Diane.
Closer.
I've got to find the way.
Closer.
The strength to stop him.
Closer.
Diane, you're almost...
Closer.
Closer.
That bottle. Nitric acid.
Closer.
The bottle.
Closer.
Got it.
Closer.
Yes.
Close to
yes.
Me.
Close to you, monster.
Closer.
Take this. Flesh. Flesh. That's all. Diane, wake up. Open your eyes. I've killed the thing. I killed it.
Oh,
Diane, it's all right.
Russell. Oh.
I've killed it.
Oh.
Diane, look. Outside, it's still dark. Yes. The sky's still streaked with the rush of meteorites. And that thing... said more of the monsters of his breed are trying to reach this earth to feel that devil's hunger in them. Another meteorite is just there. And in it, perhaps... Oh, Diane. Diane. Is that truly to be end for mankind?
This is Mr. O.R. Jobler. Remember when we started this play, I asked you to listen to it historically, in relation to other stories that you may have heard over the years about little green men arriving in flying saucers? So you see, 30 years ago, some of us were already very concerned about what might happen if, through sheer accident, an entity with attitudes and philosophies unlike our own should suddenly stumble across this very tasty, juicy morsel of the earth. Which brings us to the obvious question, do I believe in flying saucers? Well, frankly, I don't believe in that sort of supposedly super-intelligent visitors who would communicate only with one of our desert rat type of intelligences and completely ignore going to our men of science or our men of politics with their story. But I do believe in the laws of probability. I do believe that if we don't blow up our world with fission and fusion, eventually, mind you, I say eventually, some roving starship from another galaxy wandering through space might chance upon our Earth, land on it, and if they don't eat us up or exterminate us as a very undesirable tribe, might actually take pity on us and teach us, as if we were very small children, how to really live in peace and wonder on our revolving bit of dust.
It is later than you think.
My secret lair on Skull Crusher Mountain. I hope
hope that you've enjoyed your stay so far. I see you've met my assistant Scarface. His appearance is quite disturbing, but I assure you he's harmless enough. He's a sweetheart, calls me master, and he has a way of finding pretty things and bringing them to me. I get the feeling that you don't like it. What's with all the screaming? You like monkeys, you like ponies. Maybe you don't like monsters so much. Maybe I use too many monkeys. Isn't it enough to know that I ruined a pony? Making a gift for you. Well, it won't mean half as much to me if I don't have you here. No, it isn't easy living here on Skullcrusher Mountain. So maybe you could cut me just a little slack. Would it kill you to be civil? I've been patient, I've been gracious, and this mountain is covered with wolves. Hear them howling, my hungry children. Maybe you should stay and have another drink and think about me and you. Oh, and I'm so into you, but I'm way too smart for you. Even my henchmen think I'm crazy. I'm not surprised that
that was Jonathan Colton's Skullcrusher Mountain. If you're not familiar with the work of Jonathan Colton, he's an American songwriter whose songs contain themes of geek culture. He rose to prominence through the use of the internet. A few weeks ago, I played his Free Your Brains about a bunch of office workers who had turned into zombies and were beating at the door of another office worker. You really should check out Jonathan Colton. He's immensely cool. Oh, by the way, there's a video based on this song, which is available at the website. So I'm going to chip in on that one more time. It's www.nighttransmissions, one word, no space or anything between the night and the transmissions, nighttransmissions.com. When you get there, click on the navigation menu where it says the shows. From that menu, click on show 21, which is this show, And then at the bottom, there'll be a section called Downloads. And in the Downloads will be a link to the video. Anyway, got another break here. And when I come back, we're going to listen to 2000 Plus. You know, it's interesting how sometimes one is good at something that one doesn't necessarily want to be good at. Archie Obler's name had become synonymous with horror and science fiction and old-time radio. And when he moved into TV and movies, he continued in that vein. But he often told people that what he really wanted to do was to be a serious writer. I guess there were worse fates, though, than doing something you love. Maybe not the way you love it, but he certainly loved writing and becoming rich and famous for it. 2000 Plus was the first adult science fiction series to ever hit the air, although it really only beat out Dimension X by 1 or 2 months. It ran on Mutual and was half an hour long. These stories will have a charm that is always present in science fiction of the future that was written in the past. And that's the case with The Robot Killer. In The Robot Killer, a young suburban couple wins a robotic servant. And as you probably expect, nothing good comes of it. One of the things that is not clear is exactly when it ran. All we know it was sometime in 1952, but that's about it. Anyway, let's give it a listen.
2000 Plus presents The Robot Killer.
So, you are Mr. Samuel Donaldson.
Yes, sir. Happy Sam, they call me.
Yes, I know. I have friends who think your television program is very funny. I do not.
That's a living, Professor Strager. Now, may I see the mechanical man I'm giving away as the jackpot prize on my show next week?
It is not a mechanical man, Mr. Donaldson. The correct word is robot. R-O-B-O-T.
I know.
This robot is a supreme achievement of our electronics division. We've worked on it for 6 years. We'll do whatever it is instructed to do. I simply do not understand how the management of this corporation can think of giving it away to this public, this magnificent mechanism.
Oh, look, Professor, this corporation sponsors my TV show. We're on 1,246 stations. We're telecast in three-dimensional color. And the Happy Sam Show is the number two favorite in the country. The sponsor thinks it would be a good advertising gimmick to offer a super jackpot prize, a mechanical man, a robot. And I never argue with a sponsor. Now, please, may I see what I've come to see?
All right, young man, I have no choice. Come along. There it is. Experimental robot 23.
Brother. He's really something, Professor. 6 feet tall. Shiny metal. Flexible fingers. Say, how does he work?
Very simply. His electronic controls respond to ultra-high frequency waves which emanate from this microphone box. Speaking of microphone, the robot will do whatever you order him to.
Anything?
Virtually. Robot 23 has an electronic brain. You try for yourself, here.
Okay. Sing Sweet Aline.
Really, Mr. Donaldson, what a ridiculous request. Think the best scientific brains in the country work for 6 years for a robot? Heavens!
Will you be mine?
Oh, yes. It really tried to sing.
He's very clever, Professor. Hey, watch this. Pick up that broom in the corner and sweep the floor. Oh, boy, the housewives who watch my program will love this. I'll be darned. Look at there. He's doing it.
Okay, stop sweeping. What a gadget. What a giveaway. Now, let's see, something for kiddies, and I'll... Hey, what is that?
That kitten is the pet of Dr. Broderick of the physics laboratory, and I assure you, you cannot give that away.
I don't want to give the kitten away. I just want a little heartthrob on the show for the youngsters. Here, kitty. Come here, kitty. Kitty. Come here, kitty. now, kitty. Now, down the floor you go. Now, down the floor. Go ahead. And we'll show how gentle and friendly our jackpot prize robot is with pets. Now, give me the mic.
Mr. Donaldson, what are you going to do now?
Okay, Robot 23. Go over to the kitten. Pick it up. And pet the kitty. Nice kitty. Look at that. Isn't that sweet? Boy, what a camera shot on the air. Hey, what's he doing?
Robot 23, drop the kitten. Drop the kitten.
Drop kitten.
Oh, poor Tabby. Why, he killed a kitten. Broke its neck.
He tried to pet it, and he killed it. Well, you see what comes when fools play with science. No good will come of giving this robot away to the public. I warn you, no good will come of it.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Hello, this is Happy Sam the Happy Man, welcoming you to another half hour of mirth and melody. Boys, how about a fanfare? Thank you very much. Now, you know that every week for the past 4 weeks, our grand super jackpot has been growing and growing. At this moment, these are the sensational prizes in that jackpot. A free rocket plane trip for two to Paris, flying in the new 150-passenger luxury rocket cruiser at 60,000 feet, only 3 hours and 10 minutes from New York to Paris. A kitty atomic-powered sports roadster, the automobile that never needs gas or oil. It runs almost forever. A Krylon man suit tailored to your measure. Krylon is the wonder fabric guaranteed to last 100 years. And with this suit, a special set of 14 different Krylon chemical colors. Dip that suit in the color you prefer. Wear it, then change the color with another rinse. The suit is always pressed, always perfect. 14 suits in one. A complete wardrobe on your back. And the one thing money cannot buy, more money. Yes, $10,000 cash. Now, those are our jackpot prizes. And now, tonight, we add one more prize. A prize so fantastic and wonderful, nothing like it has ever been offered to a lucky winner before. This prize is a supreme achievement of modern science. It is an entire retinue of servants in one amazing machine. It is a slave to your every command. And here it is, Michael the Mechanical Man. Thank you. And now to determine who wins this giant jackpot and who wins this mechanical marvel, Michael the Mechanical Man, 1,000 slaves in one amazing machine. Now, as you know, ladies and gentlemen, each and every one of you millions of people watching this program on your visit screens are receiving this program via microwave. And now, our computators are in action. They are channeling every microwave reception on this program. When the spinner disc stops, if your television set is on, if you're the lucky person, you win the jackpot. Wait. The computator has finished. The end-air signals that the spinner disc is slowing down. And we have a winner tonight. We picked up a set who had us tuned in. Our pretty model is walking across the stage with a name. Thank you, honey. And now, here it is, the name you've all been waiting to hear. 423 North Glencoe Boulevard in Martin Hills, New York. Apartment 5B. Mr. John Hanold. Mr. John Hanold.
Down, Mr. Hanold. My practiced medical eye, judging from the smile on your face, tells me that you're pretty happy that Mrs. Hanold is being released from the hospital today.
No, it's not only that, Doctor. Don't tell me you haven't heard of my other good piece of luck.
Everyone in town's been calling me for hours before I left for the hospital.
Another good piece of luck? No, I haven't heard.
Why, I won some fabulous prizes and a giveaway show, including $10,000.
Oh?
That means your bill's going to be paid. And I also got a trip to Paris and a mechanical man and Lord knows what.
That's wonderful. I congratulate you. However, I think I would forget that trip to Paris for a while.
What?
In fact, wait a few hours before telling Mrs. Hanold about your good fortune.
Oh, what, Doctor?
Mr. Hanold, after your wife's illness, she suffered a nervous breakdown. She became mentally unstable, but she's pretty good now, thanks to what the hospital has done. However, when you take her home, she must feel she's returning to her normal life. And winning $10,000 prizes isn't very normal.
Oh, I see.
The main thing we want to avoid is a relapse. Mm-hmm. She should have a few neighbors who can drop in and see her now and then.
Well, there's Miss Barton, Virginia Barton. She lives in the apartment next to us on our floor.
Oh, yes, yes. Your wife mentioned her occasionally. Do they get along all right?
I think so. Why?
Nothing. I just wondered. Well, Mrs. Hanold's waiting for you. I know you're very anxious to get her home. Nurse, have Mrs. Hanold come in, please. I think in another month or so she'll be fine. Oh, here she is now. Hello, Mrs. Hanold.
Mary, darling, am I glad to see you.
Hello, John. Hello, Doctor.
What did I tell you? Doesn't she look fine?
Oh, she certainly does.
John, how good it is he going home. I'm as excited as a schoolgirl.
Well, now, don't get too excited. You've got to take it easy for a while.
Is that what the doctor says? He's such a worry bird.
You do what your husband says, Mrs. Hanold, and you'll just be fine.
See? Doctor's orders.
I promise. Thank you, Doctor. You'll be very kind.
I'll drop in from time to time to see you. Well, goodbye, Mrs. Hanold.
Goodbye, Doctor. All right, dear, let's go. Let's go.
John, I can hardly believe it.
Well, the doctor told me to wait until you got home before telling you.
$10,000.
And a trip to Paris. Think of it. Oh, I hope we can take it in the summer during my vacation.
And a mechanical lathe, John. Where will we put it?
Now, wait, honey. You're not supposed to get excited. Oh, my boy, who can help it?
The crazy things they give away.
Oh, I'll see who it is.
Hello, John.
Oh, hello, Virginia.
Who is it, darling?
Why, it's Virginia.
Mary, I just had to come and tell you how wonderful it is. Your being back and those wonderful prizes. It was very nice of you to come in, Virginia. And thank you for the supper you prepared for my homecoming. I was delighted to, darling. When John asked me...
John asked you to?
Well, yes, he was so happy you were coming back. But John, doesn't Mary's being home call for a celebration? Can't we have a drink?
Well, I don't know, Virginia. Mary's supposed to get rest. Still, well, I suppose one sip won't hurt. But I'll have to go out and get something, though. I'll be right back.
Oh, darling, when you get your prizes, I'll have cause to be jealous of you.
Cigarette?
No, thanks. Jealous? Why?
Well, you'll have two men, John and the robot. Poor little me, a bachelor gal all alone.
You know, I really think you ought to give me one of them.
Which one would you like to have?
Darling, what a silly question. The mechanical man, of course. He doesn't drop ashes on the rugs. He'll wash the dishes and put out the cat. He'll never argue.
You're lying to me. Why, Mary, you're serious.
What did you expect me to be? I don't understand.
But I do. In the hospital, I began to understand a lot of things. I know the doctors thought something happened to my mind. But all that happened was that it became very clear, very sharp. And for the first time, I began to think clearly.
Darling, I think this excitement's been too much for you. I shouldn't have come in.
Because I was here? Is that why you shouldn't have come in?
You're wrong, Mary. Everything you're thinking is wrong.
John would come to the hospital only once a day.
But he was working.
Some days he wouldn't come at all.
Mary, you know he has to go out of town on business
John,
once in a while.
I know many things. I would lie in my hospital bed and the shadows would whisper to me. They would say, "Where is John now? While you lie in an antiseptic bed in a hospital room that is as cold as a surgeon's knife, cutting your memories to pieces."
You frightened me.
Don't go. John will be back in a moment.
I have a headache. I've got to go.
But what will John say when you're not here?
You are darling. You poor, sick Mary.
Yes, walk out on me, Virginia. Leave me alone. But I'm not alone as I was in the hospital. I'm home now, my home. And I'm near you. Near enough to kill you. If only I could think of how to do it.
That robot's quite a guy, isn't he?
He looks something like the Tin Woodman of Oz I used to read about.
Well, I doubt so that he can do any of the things they said on that program. Now, my guess is you'll have to sell him for junk or give him away to some kids. Well, let's see. The directions say, turn on the racket switch for power, and then just talk into the microphone. Use simple phrases and precise instructions. Well, what shall I tell him to do? He's your boyfriend.
Tell him to move the green chair about 2 feet back in the corner.
Okay. Move green chair back 2 feet into corner.
John, he's walking.
That's the darndest thing I ever saw. Well, he did it. He's going to be all right.
John, does he have a name?
A name? Don't be silly.
He must have a name. He's almost like a person. Ask him.
Well, if he talk to? What is your name? Your name? Do you have a name? I see. He can't talk.
Don't ask him a question. Tell him to tell you. Do as the directions say.
Tell me your name.
Experimental Robot 23.
Robot 23.
Kind of gives me the creeps.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Well, now what I do? He can't stand there staring at us. There's nothing for him to do around here.
The poker, that steel poker in the fireplace.
Well, what about it?
He looks so strong. Tell him to bend it.
Bend it? Well, Mary, that's solid steel. He's just a tin toy with electronic nerves.
Please, John. Tell him.
But, honey, he'll probably get a short circuit or something, straining himself. Then we will have to junk him. Oh, all right, all right. Bend poker there. Bend steel poker. I see, just picked it up. But nothing's happening. Bend it. Bend it. You see, I told... Good Lord.
Oh, he's bending the steel as if it were taffy.
And did you see that? Why, it's almost as if... As if he threw it down, disdaining of showing off.
Why did you turn him off?
He's dangerous, Mary. Dangerous and frightening. I'm going to dismantle him.
No.
Now, wait, don't get so excited about it. You know what the doctor said.
Don't dismantle him, John, please.
All right, all right, all right, all right. You insist. But remember, Mary, you're not to give him any orders except when I'm home.
Darling, I wouldn't do anything that wouldn't be right for me. Almost 4 hours until John comes home. Lock the door. And now to make him come to life again. Speak to me. Say to me, hello, Mary.
Hello, Mary.
Hello, Robot 23. How nice of you to visit me. Every day you visit me. Why do you do that, tell me? Because I love you.
Because I love you.
Because you love me. Oh, Robot 23, how handsome and strong you are. And you are mine. You do what I want you to do. You are my slave. Say to me, I am your slave.
I am your slave.
That vase that Virginia gave me last year, there, the blue one. Destroy that vase. Thank you, Robot 23, very much. Of all the things in the world I have, you are the most wonderful. Because you love me and obey me and would do anything for me. Anything. Oh, the door, someone there. It can't be John. It's much too early for John. I'll see who it is, and you'll wait for me. Wait. as you always do. You.
Hello, Mary. I'm sorry to disturb you.
What do you want?
This package was delivered to my door. Something you probably ordered by phone. It's marked 5D, but your name's on it. Should have said 5B.
Yes. Yes, from the grocery.
Oh, is that the mechanical man standing in the living room?
That is Robert 23.
Does he really work? He's awfully big and clumsy looking.
He's come to visit me. He's mine. He doesn't love you.
Doesn't love... Of course not, Mary. Of course not. I'm sorry to have disturbed you. Is there anything I can do for you?
No, no, nothing. Go away. You saw her, didn't you? Say, yes, I saw her.
Yes, I saw her.
She's the one I hate. And John, John is the one I love. And you, you love me. Say, I love you.
I love you.
You must destroy her the way we destroyed the bays. Now that you've seen her, you know my secret. And you will kill her for me because you are my slave. Say, I will kill her.
I will kill her.
Virginia, it was a pleasant surprise. Why are you calling me?
It's about Mary.
Mary? Has something happened? What is it?
I rang your doorbell a few minutes ago. One of Mary's packages had been delivered to me by mistake. She came to the door.
Yes?
She acted very strangely, particularly when I asked about the mechanical man, the robot.
Well, what do you mean, Virginia, strangely?
Well, she wouldn't let me come in and look at him. She said he didn't love me.
What?
She was in a strange... Well, a strange mental state. John, are you sure she's all right?
Virginia, listen, the robot wasn't moving or doing anything, was it?
Not that I could notice. But Mary's attitude and her odd remarks...
I knew I shouldn't have accepted that tin monster. Well, I'll get home as soon as I can, Virginia. Thanks for calling.
Hello?
Dr. Rosenblatt? This is John Hanold.
Oh, yes, Mr. Hanold.
A neighbor just called me. Mary's acting strangely. I'm worried.
I don't understand, Mr. Hanold.
Well, we won some prizes on a TV show a few days ago, and one of them was a mechanical man, a robot.
Oh, yes, you told me about it.
Well, the robot, in my opinion, is a dangerous gadget. Well, anyway, one of the neighbors reported that Mary is talking strangely about it. I wonder if you could meet me at the apartment. It'll take me about half an hour to get there.
Mr. Hanold, I hope you'll forgive me, but you've got to expect that neighbors with all the goodwill in the world tend to exaggerate the actions of the people whom they've known to have been mentally ill. I'm sure there's nothing to be alarmed about.
Yes, but Doctor, this neighbor is a good friend and an intelligent woman.
Well, I've had a lot of experience in these matters, Mr. Hanold. However, to ease your mind, I'll try to drop over sometime this evening or in the morning. We'll have a talk about it. I'm in a meeting now.
Well, all right, Doctor, if you say so. Thanks very much.
Hello?
Oh, Virginia, this is John.
Yes, John.
I just spoke to the doctor. He thinks there's nothing to worry about, but... Well, I wonder if you'd do me a great favor.
Of course, John. What is it?
I've got a few things here to clean up at the desk, so I can't get home right away. I wonder if you'd go in and stay with Mary until I get there.
But, John, Frankly, I'm a little frightened.
Well, that's silly, Virginia. After all, what can happen?
The door. Wait, Robert 23, and I'll come back to you. Say, I will wait for you.
I will wait for you.
Thank you. Thank you, darling. Mary, I wonder if I could visit with you for a while.
Why?
Why do you want to visit with me?
Why, darling, I'm your neighbor. And I thought it would be very nice if we had tea. Don't you want me to come in, Mary?
Yes. Yes, I do want you to come in. Come in and meet Robert 23.
Mary, he's moved since I saw him last. He was standing by the fireplace when I was at the door before. And now he's by the sofa. Oh, darling, that lovely vase I gave you and John, it's broken. Broken in a million pieces.
I had him do it. He did it.
He did it? What do you mean?
You know what I mean. You and your lies and your deceit.
Mary, what are you doing? Why are you picking up that microphone?
Robert 23 loves me as I love John. And you won't destroy my love. You won't. Robert 23, don't you? Kill her! Kill her!
Mary! Mary!
No! No!
Virginia, please, please stop crying. Good heavens, what happened?
Mary.
Excuse me, Mr. Arnold, but I think I can tell you what happened. I'm Professor Strager, one of the men who built that robot. I came to your apartment hoping to persuade you to return the robot. I heard a dreadful commotion inside. Called this patrolman in the corner, and we forced our way in here. The robot was moving towards this young lady here.
I tried to get away. Wherever I went, it came after
me. I cut off the control box and stopped the robot.
Mary wanted to kill me, John. Kill me.
Doctor. How's Mary? Is she all right?
I've given her sedatives, Mr. Arnold. I'll take her back to the hospital in a few hours. All of this excitement. Yeah, however, I'm sure she'll be all right in another month or two.
But she tried to kill me. She tried to kill me.
For some reason, she was jealous of you. But now that we know her obsession, we can treat it psychiatrically.
And she'll be all right, Doctor. She won't try to kill again. And I think what might have happened to Virginia...
Mr. Arnold, nothing would have happened.
You see, your wife told the robot to kill, but that was not an instruction the robot could carry out.
What do you mean, Professor? You said yourself the robot was going toward Virginia.
Yes, of course, because your wife said go to her. A simple physical action the robot is capable of performing due to its directional mechanism. However, the command kill is not sufficiently explicit. The robot cannot kill in general. Must have step-by-step instructions as to how the command is to be carried out. You see, Mr. Hanold, I might put it this way. To strike out blindly, to kill without thinking, requires an emotional drive, the capacity to hate. And that the robot cannot do. It is, after all, a machine, not a human being.
Well, that turned out a little bit differently than I was expecting when I first heard it. Probably a little bit differently than you did, too. Of course, by this time, Isaac Asimov had come up with his three laws of robotics. You know the three laws, right? Well, just in case you don't, I'm going to go ahead and quote them. They're short. Law 1. A robot may not injure a human being or, through an action, allow a human being to come to harm. Law 2. A robot must obey any orders given to it by human beings except when such orders would conflict with the first law. Law 3. A robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first or second law. Asimov was always a little bit vague about how these laws were implemented. They were just somehow built into the very structure of the robot's positronic brain. These three laws were so widely adopted that it became almost impossible to do a robot goes crazy and kills everyone kind of story. Not that they weren't done. They were. As far as the sound quality of that particular episode is concerned, I did struggle with it a little bit. I wish I knew more about how to clean these things up. I use a program called Audacity, which is wonderful and has a lot of plugins. But I'm nothing like a sound engineer, and I barely know what's going on. I guess I really kind of need to do that if I'm going to continue to do this. I need to learn how to improve the sound of these old shows. Back. Did you miss me? Nah, probably not. This last half hour, we're going to start off with a recording from the LibriVox project, or maybe it's pronounced the LibriVox project. I've heard it pronounced both ways, and I have no idea. Anyway, the short story is from Robert E. Howard. It's one of his Solomon Kane stories. It's called Skulls in the Stars. It's read by Paul Siegel, and was first published in Weird Tales during January of 1929. In this story, Solomon Kane is in England and on his way to the hamlet of Turkertown, and is faced with two paths. Now, one of them goes through a moor, and one of them goes through a swamp. Someone tells him that the moor is haunted and that all the travelers who take that route die. So, of course, Solomon, being Solomon Kane, decides to investigate. After which, I'll close the show with a bit of music. See you next week, I hope. Bye for now.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to find out how you can volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Paul Siegel of Maynard, Massachusetts. Skulls in the Stars by Robert E. Howard. He told how murderers walk the earth beneath the curse of Cain, with crimson clouds before their eyes and flames about their brain, for blood has left upon their souls its everlasting stain. Hood. Part 1. There are two roads to Turkertown. One, the shorter and more direct route, leads across a barren upland moor, and the other, which is much longer, winds its tortuous way in and out among the hummocks and quagmires of the swamps, skirting the low hills to the east. It was a dangerous and tedious trail, so Solomon Kane halted in amazement when a breathless youth from the village he had just left overtook him and implored him for God's sake to take the swamp road. "The swamp road?" Kane stared at the boy. He was a tall, gaunt man, was Solomon Kane. His darkly pallid face and deep, brooding eyes made more somber by the drab, puritanical garb he affected. "Yes, sir, 'tis far safer," the youngster answered his surprised exclamation. "Then the moor road must be haunted by Satan himself, for your townsman warned me against traversing the other." "Because of the quagmire, sir, that you might not see in the dark. You had better return to the village and continue your journey in the morning, sir."
"Taking the swamp road?"
"Yes, sir."
Kane shrugged his shoulders and shook his head. "The moon rises almost as soon as twilight dies. By its light I can reach Turkertown in a few hours, across the moor."
"Sir, you had better not. No one ever goes that way. There are no houses at all upon the moor, while in the swamp there is the house of old Ezra, who lives there all alone since his maniac cousin, Gideon, wandered off and died in the swamp and was never found. And old Ezra, though a miser, would not refuse you lodging should you decide to stop until morning. Since you must go, you had better go the swamp road."
Kane eyed the boy piercingly. The lad squirmed and shuffled his feet. "Since this moor road is so dour to wayfarers," said the Puritan, "why did not the villagers tell me the whole tale instead of vague mouthings?"
"Men like not to talk of it, sir. We hoped that you would take the swamp road after the men advised you to, but when we watched and saw that you turned not at the forks, they sent me to run after you and beg you to reconsider."
"Name of the devil!" exclaimed Cain sharply, the unaccustomed oath showing his irritation. "The swamp road and the moor road, What is it that threatens me, and why should I go miles out of my way and risk the bogs and mires? Sir, said the boy, dropping his voice and drawing closer, we be simple villagers who like not to talk of such things, lest foul fortune befall us. But the Moor Road is a way accursed and hath not been traversed by any of the countryside for a year or more. It is death to walk those moors by night, as hath been found by some score of unfortunates. Some foul horror haunts the way and claims men for his victims. So, and what is this thing like? No man knows. None has ever seen it and lived. But latefarers have heard terrible laughter far out on the fen, and men have heard the horrid shrieks of its victims. Sir, in God's name, return to the village, there pass the night, and tomorrow take the swamp trail to Torkertown. Far back in Cain's gloomy eyes, a scintillant light had begun to glimmer, like a witch's torch glinting under the fathoms of cold gray ice. His blood quickened. Adventure! The lure of life risk and drama! Not that Cain recognized his sensations as such. He sincerely considered that he voiced his real feelings when he said, These things be deeds of some power of evil. The lords of darkness have laid a curse upon the country. A strong man is needed to combat Satan and his might. Therefore I go, who have defied him many a time. Sir, the boy began, then closed his mouth as he saw the futility of argument. He only added, The corpses of the victims are bruised and torn, sir. He stood there at the crossroads, sighing regretfully as he watched the tall, rangy figure swinging up the road that led toward the moors. The sun was setting as Cain came over the brow of the low hill which debouched into the upland fen. Huge and blood-red it sank down behind the sullen horizon of the moors, seeming to touch the rank grass with fire, so for a moment the watcher seemed to be gazing out across a sea of blood. Then the dark shadows came gliding from the east, the western blaze faded, and Solomon Cain struck out boldly in the gathering darkness. The road was dim from disuse, but was clearly defined. Cain went swiftly but warily, sword and pistols at hand. Stars blinked out, and night winds whispered among the grass like weeping spectres. The moon began to rise, lean and haggard, like a skull among the stars. Then suddenly Cain stopped short. From somewhere in front of him sounded a strange and eerie echo, or something like an echo. Again, this time louder. Cain started forward again. Were his senses deceiving him? No! Far out there pealed a whisper of frightful laughter, and again, closer this time. No human being ever laughed like that. There was no mirth in it, only hatred and horror and soul-destroying terror. Cain halted. He was not afraid, but for the second he was almost unnerved. Then, stabbing through that awesome laughter, came the sound of a scream that was undoubtedly human. Cain started forward, increasing his gait. He cursed the elusive lights and flickering shadows which veiled the moor in the rising moon and made accurate sight impossible. The laughter continued, growing louder, as did the screams. Then sounded faintly the drum of frantic human feet. Cain broke into a run. Some human was being hunted to his death out there on the fen, and by what manner of horror God alone knew. The sound of the flying feet halted abruptly, and the screaming rose unbearably, mingled with other sounds unnameable and hideous. Evidently the man had been overtaken, and Cain, his flesh crawling, visualized some ghastly fiend of the darkness crouching on the back of its victim, crouching and tearing. Then the noise of a terrible and short struggle came clearly through the abysmal silence of the fen, and the footfalls began again, but stumbling and uneven. The screaming continued, but with a gasping gurgle. The sweat stood cold on Cain's forehead and body. This was heaping horror on horror in an intolerable manner. God, for a moment's clear light! The frightful drama was being enacted within a very short distance of him, to judge by the ease with which the sound reached him. But this hellish half-light veiled all in shifting shadows, so that the moors appeared a haze of blurred illusions, and stunted trees and bushes seemed like giants. Cain shouted, striving to increase the speed of his advance. The shrieks of the unknown broke into a hideous shrill squealing. Again there was the sound of a struggle, and then from the shadows of the tall grass a thing came reeling, a thing that had once been a man, a gore-covered, frightful thing that fell at Cain's feet, and writhed and groveled and raised its terrible face to the rising moon, and gibbered and yammered, and fell down again and died in its own blood. The moon was up now, and the light was better. Kane bent above the body, which lay stark in its unnameable mutilation, and he shuddered, a rare thing for him who had seen the deeds of the Spanish Inquisition and the witch-finders. Some wayfarer, he supposed. Then, like a hand of ice on his spine, he was aware that he was not alone. He looked up, his cold eyes piercing the shadows whence the dead man had staggered. He saw nothing, but he knew, he felt, that other eyes gave back his stare, terrible eyes not of this earth. He straightened and drew a pistol, waiting. The moonlight spread like a lake of pale blood over the moor, and trees and grasses took on their proper sizes. The shadows melted, and Kane saw! At first he thought it only a shadow of mist, a wisp of moor fog that swayed in the tall grass before him. He gazed. More illusion, he thought. Then the thing began to take on shape, vague and indistinct. Two hideous eyes flamed at him, eyes which held all the stark horror which has been the heritage of man since the fearful dawn ages, eyes frightful and insane, with an insanity transcending earthly insanity. The form of the thing was misty and vague, a brain-shattering travesty on the human form, like, yet horribly unlike. The grass and bushes beyond showed clearly through it. Kane felt the blood pound in his temples, yet he was cold as ice. How such an unstable being as that which wavered before him could harm a man in a physical way was more than he could understand, yet the red horror at his feet gave mute testimony that the fiend could act with terrible material effect. Of one thing Kane was sure. There would be no hunting of him across the dreary moors, no screaming and fleeing to be dragged down again and again. If he must die, he would die in his tracks, his wounds in front. Now a vague and grisly mouth gaped wide, and the demonic laughter again shrieked out, soul-shaking in its nearness. And in the midst of that threat of doom, Kane deliberately leveled his long pistol and fired. A maniacal yell of rage and mockery answered the report, and the thing came at him like a flying sheet of smoke, long shadowy arms stretched to drag him down. Kane, moving with the dynamic speed of a famished wolf, fired the second pistol with as little effect, snatched his long rapier from its sheath, and thrust into the center of the misty attacker. The blade sang as it passed clear through, encountering no solid resistance, and Kane felt icy fingers grip his limbs, bestial talons tear his garments and the skin beneath. He dropped the useless sword and sought to grapple with his foe. It was like fighting a floating mist, a flying shadow armed with dagger-like claws. His savage blows met empty air. His leanly mighty arms, in whose grasp strong men had died, swept nothingness and clutched emptiness. Naught was solid or real save the flaying, ape-like fingers with their crooked talons and the crazy eyes which burned into the shuddering depths of his soul. Kane realized that he was in a desperate plight indeed. Already his garments hung in tatters, and he bled from a score of deep wounds. But he never flinched, and the thought of flight never entered his mind. He had never fled from a single foe, and had the thought occurred to him, he would have flushed with shame. He saw no help for it now, but that his form should lie there beside the fragments of the other victim. But the thought held no terrors for him. His only wish was to give as good an account of himself as possible before the end came, and if he could, to inflict some damage on his unearthly foe. There above the dead man's torn body, man fought with demon under the pale light of the rising moon, with all the advantages with the demon, save one. And that one was enough to overcome all the others. For if abstract hate may bring into material substance a ghostly thing, may not courage, equally abstract, form a concrete weapon to combat that ghost? Kane fought with his arms and his feet and his hands, and he was aware at last that the ghost began to give back before him, that the fearful laughter changed to screams of baffled fury. For man's only weapon is courage that flinches not from the gates of hell itself, and against such not even the legions of hell can stand. Of this Kane knew nothing. He only knew that the talons which tore and rended him seemed to grow weaker and wavering, that a wild light grew and grew in the horrible eyes, and reeling and gasping he rushed in, grappled the thing at last, and threw it, and as they tumbled about on the moor, and it writhed and lapped his limbs like a serpent of smoke, his flesh crawled and his hair stood on end, for he began to understand its gibbering. He did not hear and comprehend as a man hears and comprehends the speech of a man, but the frightful secrets it imparted in whisperings and yammerings and screaming silences sank fingers of ice and flame into his soul, and he knew. Part 2. The hut of old Ezra the Miser stood by the road in the midst of the swamp, half screened by the sullen trees which grew about it. The walls were rotting, the roof crumbling, and great pallid and green fungus monsters clung to it and writhed about the doors and windows, as if seeking to peer within. The trees leaned above it, and their gray branches intertwined so that it crouched in the semi-darkness like a monstrous dwarf over whose shoulder ogres leer. The road which wound down into the swamp, among rotting stumps and rank hummocks and scummy, snake-haunted pools and bogs, crawled past the hut. Many people passed that way these days, but few saw old Ezra, save a glimpse of a yellow face peering through the fungus-green windows, itself like an ugly fungus. Old Ezra the miser partook much of the quality of the swamp, for he was gnarled and bent and sullen. His fingers were like clutching parasitic plants, and his locks hung like drab moss above the eyes trained to the murk of the swamplands. His eyes were like a dead man's, yet hinted of depths abysmal and loathsome as the dead lakes of the swamplands. These eyes gleamed now at the man who stood in front of his hut. This man was tall and gaunt and dark. His face was haggard and claw-marked, and he was bandaged of arm and leg. Somewhat behind this man stood a number of villagers. "You are Ezra of the Swamp Road?"
"Aye, and what want ye of me?"
"Where is your cousin Gideon, the maniac youth who abode with you?"
"Gideon?"
"Aye."
"He wandered away into the swamp and never came back. No doubt he lost his way and was set upon by wolves, or died in a quagmire, or was struck by an adder."
"How long ago?"
"Over a year."
"Aye, hark ye, Ezra the miser. Soon after your cousin's disappearance, a countryman, coming home across the moors, was set upon by some unknown fiend and torn to pieces, and thereafter it became death to cross those moors. First men of the countryside, then strangers who wandered over the fen, fell to the clutches of the thing. Many men have died since the first one. Last night I crossed the moors, and heard the flight and pursuing of another victim, a stranger who knew not the evil of the moors. Ezra the miser, it was a fearful thing, for the wretch twice broke from the fiend, terribly wounded, and each time the demon caught and dragged him down again. And at last he fell dead at my very feet, done to death in a manner that would freeze the statue of a saint." The villagers moved restlessly and murmured fearfully to each other, and old Ezra's eyes shifted furtively. Yet the somber expression of Solomon Cain never altered, and his condor-like stare seemed to transfix the miser.
Aye, muttered old Ezra hurriedly. "A bad thing, a bad thing. Yet why do you tell this thing to me?"
"Aye, a sad thing. Hearken further, Ezra. The fiend came out over the shadows, and I fought with it, over the body of its victim. Aye, how I overcame it, I know not, for the battle was hard and long. But the powers of good and light were on my side, which are mightier than the powers of hell. At the last I was stronger, and it broke from me and fled, and I followed to no avail. Yet before it fled it whispered to me a monstrous truth." Old Ezra started, stared wildly, seeming to shrink into himself.
"Nay, why tell me this?" he muttered.
"I returned to the village and told my tale," said Cain, "for I knew that now I had the power to rid the moors of its curse forever. Ezra, come with us."
"Where?"
gasped the miser. "To the rotting oak on the moors." Ezra reeled as though struck. He screamed incoherently and turned to flee. On the instant, at Cain's sharp order, two brawny villagers sprang forward and seized the miser. They twisted the dagger from his withered hand and pinioned his arms, shuddering as their fingers encountered his clammy flesh. Cain motioned them to follow, and turning strode up the trail, followed by the villagers, who found their strength taxed to the utmost in their task of bearing their prisoner along. Through the swamp they went and out, taking a little-used trail which led up over the low hills and out on the moors. The sun was sliding down the horizon, and old Ezra stared at it with bulging eyes, stared as if he could not gaze enough. Far out on the moors reared up the great oak tree, like a gibbet, now only a decaying shell. There Solomon Cain halted. Old Ezra writhed in his captor's grasp and made inarticulate noises. "Over a year ago," said Solomon Cain, "you, fearing that your insane cousin Gideon would tell men of your cruelties to him, brought him away from the swamp by the very trail by which we came, and murdered him here in the night." Ezra cringed and snarled.
"You cannot prove this lie!"
Cain spoke a few words to an agile villager. The youth clambered up the rotting bole of the tree, and from a crevice high up dragged something that fell with a clatter at the feet of the miser. Ezra went limp with a terrible shriek. The object was a man's skeleton, the skull cleft.
You? How knew you this? You are Satan! Gibbered old Ezra.
The thing I fought last night told me this thing as we reeled in battle, and I followed it to this tree, for the fiend is Gideon's ghost. Ezra shrieked again and fought savagely. You knew, said Cain somberly. You knew what thing did these deeds. You feared the ghost of the maniac, and that is why you chose to leave his body on the fen instead of concealing it in the swamp, for you knew the ghost would haunt the place of his death. He was insane in life, and in death he did not know where to find his slayer, else he had come to you in your hut. He hates no man but you, but his mazed spirit cannot tell one man from another, and he slays all, lest he let his killer escape. Yet he will know you and rest in peace forever after. Hate hath made of his ghost a solid thing that can rend and slay, and though he feared you terribly in life, in death he fears you not. Cain halted. He glanced at the sun. All this I had from Gideon's ghost, and his yammerings and his whisperings and his shrieking silences. Naught but your death will lay that ghost. Ezra listened in breathless silence, and Cain pronounced the words of his doom. A hard thing it is, said Cain somberly, to sentence a man to death in cold blood, and in such a manner as I have in mind. But you must die that others may live, and God knoweth you deserve death. You shall not die by noose, bullet, or sword, but at the talons of him you slew, for naught else will satiate him. At these words Ezra's brain shattered. His knees gave way, and he fell groveling and screaming for death, begging them to burn him at the stake, to flay him alive. Cain's face was set like death, and the villagers, the fear rousing their cruelty, bound the screaming wretch to the oak tree, and one of them bade him make his peace with God. But Ezra made no answer, shrieking in a high, shrill voice with unbearable monotony. Then the villager would have struck the miser across the face, but Cain stayed him. "Let him make his peace with Satan, whom he is more like to meet," said the Puritan grimly. "The sun is about to set. Loose his cords so that he may work loose by dark, since it is better to meet death free and unshackled than bound like a sacrifice." As they turned to leave him, old Ezra yammered and gibbered unhuman sounds, and then fell silent, staring at the sun with terrible intensity. They walked across the fen, and Cain flung a last look at the grotesque form bound to the tree, seeming in the uncertain light like a great fungus growing to the bole. And suddenly the miser screamed hideously, "Death! Death! There are skulls in the stars!" Life was good to him, though he was gnarled and churlish and evil, Cain sighed. Mayhap God has a place for such souls where fire and sacrifice may cleanse them of their dross, as fire cleanses the forest of fungus things. Yet my heart is heavy within me. "Nay, sir," one of the villagers spoke, "you have done but the will of God, and good alone shall come of this night's deed." "Nay," answered Cain heavily, "I know not, I know not." The sun had gone down, and night spread with amazing swiftness, as if great shadows came rushing down from unknown voids to cloak the world with hurrying darkness. Through the thick night came a weird echo, and the men halted and looked back the way they had come. Nothing could be seen. The moor was an ocean of shadows, and the tall grass about them bent in long waves before the faint wind, breaking the deathly stillness with breathless murmurings. Then far away the red disk of the moon rose over the fen, and for an instant a grim silhouette was etched blackly against it. A shape came flying across the face of the moon, a bent, grotesque thing whose feet seemed scarcely to touch the earth, and close behind came a thing like a flying shadow, a nameless, shapeless horror. A moment the racing twain stood out boldly against the moon, then they merged into one unnameable, formless mass and vanished in the shadows. Far across the fen sounded a single shriek of terrible laughter.
And with that, so ends the dramatic presentation portion of Night Transmissions. And so for the remaining few minutes together, I'm going to play a little bit of music. I hope to play here things you have either never heard or haven't heard in a long time.
The kitchen gone, and word is to the hall, word is up to Madam the Queen, and that's the worst of all, that Mary Hamerton's born a babe to the highest steward of all. Arise, arise, Mary Hamerton, what thou hast done with thy wee babe, I saw and heard weep by thee. I put him in a tiny boat and cast him out to sea, that he might sink or he swim, but he'd never come back to me. Arise, arise, Mary Hamilton, arise and come with me. There is a wedding in Glasgow town this night.
Never have was married.